copyright Forum of Christian Leaders. The contents contained on this website are solely for your own individual, non-commercial, and informational use. Any other use is strictly prohibited without our express prior written consent. See the full copyright disclosure at focalonline.org.
The question of why mindfulness, why take this as a whole topic and spend three sessions on it? How many of you are using any form of mindfulness in your practice at the moment? One, two, three, four, anyone? Five? Yeah. And how many of you have read things about it and studied it a bit? Yeah? Yeah? It may seem an odd topic to spend a whole lot of time on, and yet we know that the whole culture is sort of throwing mindfulness in our direction. So I, for my own sake, and hopefully some benefit to you, I have spent a large amount of time in the last year or two thinking about mindfulness and trying to just understand from a Christian perspective what to think of it. So that's what I'm going to do with you. So it's an exercise, in a sense, in Christian discernment. How can we think Christianly about this practice that is flooding in from everywhere? So we'll be looking a little bit at the history and development of mindfulness. We'll be asking, how is it used in counseling and therapy? What does the research show about mindfulness? What about its Buddhist roots? Does that matter? Where do we have common ground with mindfulness as Christians? And what is the mind of Christ? If we talk about being mindful, and the scripture used talks about having the mind of Christ. And then finally, how does it relate to Christian traditions of mindful and contemplative prayer? Now, this is going to help you somewhat in your work of counseling. Hopefully it will also help you in your own individual devotional life to think about how you might pray, how you might relate to the Lord in times of contemplative prayer. So as we look at the history, a little history, back to the 1960s and the Beatles in India, long before most of you were born, but still within my lifetime. And the popular, at that time, it was transcendental meditation that was so popular and claimed to be good for everyone, so that even the military were using transcendental meditation. It was coming into schools as a form of helpful calming for children. And my wife and I set off back in 1971. Here we are in our hippie days, a little more hair on my head, and we traveled for a year. That was our honeymoon, around the world on the hippie trail. And part of it was a questioning of, is Christianity the only way to God? I had grown up in a Christian home and had known the Lord as long as I can remember. My wife was a very recently converted from a non-Christian home. And so we wanted to look at this question. What, maybe there's truth in Hinduism and Buddhism and Islam, and maybe they're all the same thing ultimately, pointing like the spokes of a wheel to a common hub. We came back far more convinced of the truth of Christianity than when we left, in contrast to the others. But it's left me with an abiding interest in Eastern mysticism and practices that seem to come out of the East. So, and then probably in the 1980s, late 70s, 80s, there was a guy in the States called Herbert Benson, a physician, a psychiatrist, who developed a form of meditation, which he said, you don't need a mantra for transcendental meditation. All you need to do is say the word one, or relax again and again, and it will help you to relax and get you into a calm frame of mind. And so along the way, since that time, there have been various sort of surges, and most recently, There was a new issue of Time, special issue of Time magazine on the mindful revolution, and then another one here. And a spate of books, of articles, many of them referencing the benefits of mindfulness, both in medicine and in psychotherapy. So a research, if you researched the internet on special search engine called PubMed, between 1969 and 1978, there were only 10 articles on mindfulness. There were 300 between 1990 and 2008, and almost 2,000 articles between 2009 and 2013. So a huge sort of upsurge in the research and the interest. And one person whose name is well known in relation to mindfulness, Jon Kabat-Zinn, who was working at the University of Massachusetts Medical Center, started to use it in therapy. And then Marcia Linehan, if any of you have done work with borderline personalities, you know that she was someone who pioneered this. She was using mindfulness in therapy as a powerful tool to help suicidal and volatile and particularly challenging patients. Then in 1995, cognitive therapies for depression began to use mindfulness. And that was called mindfulness-based cognitive therapy. And there were dramatic results, dramatic claims were made in the early 2000s that it cut the relapse rate of depression by half. That was particularly some work that came out of Oxford in the UK. And then it was used in anxiety, it was used preventing relapse in addictions. You may know the name of Andrew Weil, especially if you're from the United States, this bearded prophet-looking guy. But he has a sort of mixture of traditional medicine and non-traditional medicine, which there are a lot of good things in what he does. There's a lot of really helpful stuff in relation to diet, but mindfulness is a big thing for him. And Jack Kornfield is another of the sort of gurus of mindfulness in the psychological world. And then Dan Siegel down here, that we'll get to later on, is very much a contemporary proponent of something that he got into it not realizing that it was actually mindfulness. He started to do something with clients and then realized that it was much the same as what people were doing. So the claims were that, you know, that and now there are meditation books, DVDs, tons of mindfulness apps that you can get for your phone. It's a huge industry. And the big companies like Google and Microsoft and others have experts coming in and teaching all their employees mindfulness and stress reduction. So this is a magazine that I read very regularly, the Psychotherapy Networker, which sort of keeps me on the cutting edge of a lot of what's going on in psychotherapy. Some years ago, probably about 10 years ago, this was their cover, suggesting there's a certain suspicion in the traditional psychiatric and psychological world of mindfulness. They're not quite ready for it yet. But a few years later, this is what happened. So there's this sort of syncretism of psychotherapy and Eastern mysticism, enlightenment, and part of that is mindfulness. Another later version of the Psychotherapy Networker, mindfulness goes viral. And in January 2015, there was a New York Times article on it. There were books coming out like Mindful Work, Mindful Birthing, The Mindful Teen, The Mindful Way Through Stress. You could do everything in life mindfully. And then there were one or two who were somewhat critical. One psychiatrist wrote that he was really disturbed that mindfulness was being prescribed for his bipolar patients who were potentially suicidal, and they were being taken off their medication and given mindfulness. And he said, this is really dangerous. We shouldn't be doing this. And he saw it, as you can see in this article in the Washington Post, as a somewhat selfish, very self-focused type of meditation. And then in England, some of you who know the little Ladybird books, which are usually for children, but they also do some sort of satirical critiques of various trends in society. And one writer writing about mindfulness said, at times mindfulness seems like this year's kale, a hipster buzzword on the brink of wearing out its welcome. And in this book, it's the sort of butt of jokes. So there's one page of someone floating in a beautiful lake, and it comments, Wendell achieves a state of mindfulness by imagining that he is floating in a beautiful lake until his mind empties of everyday worries. Soon he's aware of himself, but no longer worried about money, work, family, or whether he left the taps on. Many home insurance policies now cover acts of mindfulness. Or another picture, Clive likes to practice loving-kindness meditation. This is when someone thinks of a friend and then sends them love. Clive finds this a whole lot easier than bothering to meet his friends or lending them money. So this is the sort of somewhat cynical critique of this as being rather a selfish, self-focused enterprise. Then Scientific American Mind, just a few years ago, came out with this special article on how the science of mindfulness can improve attention and lift your mood. And Time magazine did another special edition on mindfulness, interestingly with the same photograph they'd used some years before. So the question then is, what is... the subtitle of the... I think this one here in the actual magazine was Waves of Emotion May Roil the Surface, but 30 feet down, all is peaceful. By tuning to every breath as it travels through your body, you can dive into that basal oasis. So what then is mindfulness? And this is really the essence of what it is. It is the striving to focus on the present. So Kabat-Zinn, in his definition, this is the classic definition that you'll often see quoted. Here is Kabat-Zinn himself, a professor in Massachusetts. He says, mindfulness means paying attention, one part of it, in a particular way, on purpose, in the present moment, and non-judgmentally. Paying attention in a particular way, on purpose, in the present moment, non-judgmentally. So it's really all about awareness. There's one person who's written a book about mindfulness for kids called Sitting Still Like a Frog. That's where that little image of the frog comes from. But you know how frogs just sit and their eyes are going, looking around. They're not moving, but they're aware of everything that's going on around them. So just to, it's sort of like this. It means learning to stop, to look, to listen, to taste, to feel, and to smell. Now, what could be wrong with that? It's pretty psychosis. Basic to life. What did you say?
Psychosis.
Psychosis could be wrong with it. What do you mean?
Psychosis.
It could lead to psychosis?
Yeah.
You think?
Yeah.
Because people don't want to face what's inside, you mean?
No, they overdo it.
Oh, they overdo it. Okay. So they retreat too much from the world and go into their own world.
Leave reality.
Okay, we'll come to that. There are cautions about the use of mindfulness. But in terms of its everyday use, one of the simple exercises that they often use would be if I handed around to each of you a raisin or a raspberry or a blueberry, something like that. And I asked you just for a moment just to sit still and look at that raisin. Look at all the beautiful wrinkles, the way the light catches the surface of the raisin, and the texture and the color, the contours. And then smell it, probably not a lot of smell with a raisin, and then put it in your mouth and just hold it on your tongue. Don't bite into it. And then roll it around in your mouth, feel its texture. You begin to get a little bit of taste. And then slowly and gently just bite into that raisin, just one bite, and feel the juice coming out into your mouth, spreading around your mouth, and the sweet sensation of it. And then slowly chew it and eat it. Now, how do you normally eat a raisin? You pop it in and you chew it and it's gone and you barely notice. That was nice, but you hardly notice it. You go for a walk in the woods and you're talking with a friend or you're listening to your phone, to music on your phone. You're not noticing what's going on in the woods, the smells, the bird song, the beauty of the sunlight through the trees. So it's sort of going back, and the mindfulness folk talk about this like beginner's mind. You need to learn to eat again. You've never learned. And you need a beginner's mind of how to walk through the woods. Many years ago, a friend of mine took me bird watching just after I'd finished my medical exams. We just went away for 2 or 3 days and sat in the marshes watching birds at dawn, and it was the most exquisite experience of being still and noticing nature. And now I always hear bird song. I wake up in the morning here and I hear bird song, the blackcaps singing out in the trees outside. But so here is what mindfulness, the core nature of mindfulness. It is centering down. So, and we'll do a little exercise, a sort of abbreviated exercise in a moment. Focusing on your breathing, being aware of sounds and sensations and ideas going on inside you, and then observing what comes and goes. So observing what you're feeling in your body, observing what you are thinking, and then what emotions are coming in your being. So you're really stopping long enough to slow down and listen to yourself, be more self-aware. You watch what comes and goes. Now, we know that but deep breathing calms the autonomic nervous system, don't we? So if you breathe in and breathe out with a little pause in between, which helps it, and you have a longer expiration, a longer breath out than in, and you breathe primarily with your diaphragm, so you're breathing with stomach, what we might call stomach breathing, where your stomach is going out rather than your chest going up and down, that calms the vagus nerve, which runs from your brain right down through your body, calms the autonomic system. It balances the sympathetic and the parasympathetic. The calming system of the parasympathetic and the sympathetic, which is the alert fight or flight system. So you actually strengthen, as you use deep breathing exercises, you strengthen your prefrontal cortex's ability to react calmly in the face of stressful situations. So breathing is important, being aware, being able to, what they talk about is watching the thoughts that come. They talk about the lazy river exercise. You know, it's like seeing a boat float down a slow river or clouds going across the sky. You watch the thought gosh, I'm really worried about what I'm going to do when I get back. I've got so many speaking engagements, or I've got so much to do in relation to that committee that I haven't done. And you don't grab hold of it and start worrying and stressing. You just say, ah, interesting thought. And you let it travel out across your mind and sort of out the other side. And you don't judge it or interpret. You stay with it, with this process, and live in the moment, as they say, paying attention to the garden of now. And if you were able to sit and practice this, 20 minutes a day or more, and it is a practice that doesn't come easily. And I'll say a bit more about that in a moment. There's one Buddhist, Tibetan Buddhist monk called Thich Nhat Hanh, I think it is, that's his name, who's written a pretty well-known book on this. And he says, when you walk, when you sit, when you make tea, when you wash dishes, when you wash clothes, you should be mindful. Now I say to that, amen, brother, in a sense. This is about the lordship of Christ over the whole of life. That whatever you do, whether you're washing dishes or whether you're gardening or whether you're praying, you do it before the face of God. This is spirituality. This is the lordship of Christ over the whole of life. And there's a parallel to being still in the presence of God, that the scripture talks about, prayer and meditation in the presence of God. Now, the mindfulness folk are not speaking about it quite in that way. So it's awareness of internal, and I may be a little repetitive here just to make the point, but it's without prejudice and opinion and evaluation. I think that'll become clearer as we go along. An example in one of the books on mindfulness, you get a response to a twinge of pain. You have back pain, say, and you get a twinge, or you have pain in your head, and you think, oh no, I'm going to get one of my headaches. I'll miss that meeting. I'll let everyone down yet again. Why does this always happen to me? I'm so sick of my life. It's that sort of catastrophic avalanche of engaging with the stressful thought, rather than saying, there's a bit of a headache. Let me just sit with it, let it be, and maybe it will fade away again, that you don't need to add to the stress of it. So they talk about this as the mad monkey mind, when your mind just gets active and grabs, and a thought stream of worries and plans and concerns, all trying to figure things out, that's almost unstoppable. Fears and fantasies about the future and regrets about the past. Jack Kornfield says, if you look at what's going on in your mind, 95% of it is returns of old thoughts. You keep reprocessing the same things over and over again, especially worries. There's something odd about this, because the old sort of way of dealing with anxiety is that you need to fight it and push it out of your mind and wrestle with it and deal with it. Here we're sort of saying, just let it be, watch it, and it will have less power over you than if you start to fight it. So contrast this then with mindlessness, which is where most of us live, which is the rushing through activities, the multitasking of every day, the failing to notice feelings, the not being aware of the body, being preoccupied with the future or the past, not being present. As I said, it's sort of walking through the woods and barely aware of the woods. And you imagine, how do you ask a young mother with kids to be mindful? Her mind is going all over the place. It's really hard to find an island in the day to be able to be still. And when we have the ever-present phone in your pocket. When you're bored, what do? You pull it out and you look, and you immediately react to the vibration or the ting, because your brain has been trained by your phone to respond in that sort of way. So it's focusing attention not in the past or the future, on the present awareness. It's learning, it's sort of teaching yourself to regulate your attention. And it's an awareness of present experience with acceptance. So, and this is where I think it gets into the concept of cultivating intimacy with oneself. So we live at a fast pace with all sorts of things going on, and we think we know ourselves when very often we don't. We use the busyness to actually keep us from being aware of what's going on inside. So mindfulness is helping people to be in touch with their body, their emotions, and their thoughts. So as you do this, you begin to notice how self-focused you are, and you begin to feel a greater connection with the world around you, with other people, with the woods, with birdsong, with nature, with the taste of food that you haven't really noticed very much before. And you also, they would claim, become a more compassionate, kind, and grateful person. They would also say you need to exercise the disciplines of compassion, kindness, and gratitude. You need to develop these, work on these. Just as you practice this self-awareness, you need to practice the compassion to others. And you learn a mindful listening to others. And I think when you're really focused in counseling, you are actually mindfully listening, because you're not very aware of anything else going on around you, are you? You're listening to the person's voice, you're focusing on their face, their body, their emotions, what they're saying. It is a very focused awareness. So in some areas of life, you do it already, hopefully. So slowing down, paying attention, and this is part of what we would say is emotional and social intelligence. So let's do this for a few minutes. What I'm going to do is truncate or reduce and combine several, I just want to be able to sit down here, several areas of parts of this. So you wouldn't do it in this way with all of these different parts, because we're going to focus on our breathing, which is the basic exercise. We would do that on its own. And then we're going to go on to focus on our bodies, and then the thoughts in our minds. Okay? So each of these you might do separately. And there are lots of places on the internet where you can get mindfulness exercises. There are CDs, there are downloads of these things where you can teach yourself, practice apps that you can get. So just get comfortable with your feet firmly on the floor, grounded, as we say. Maybe just your arms on the side of the chair, or on your hands on your thighs, and a straight back. And you can keep your eyes open. I find it better with my eyes closed. And we'll just do one or two deeper breaths for relaxation. We'll count four in, and then slight pause, and then six out. And I find it helpful to breathe in through my nose and out through slightly pursed lips. So I'll count you through this. In, one, two, three, four. Slight pause, and then out, one, two, three, four, five, six, in, four, out, five, six. And as you do this, just become aware of one part of the breath cycle. You can be aware of the air going in and out through your nose and your mouth, or it might be the rise and fall of your stomach or your chest. Just one part of the breath cycle. Just become aware of that and notice it and focus your attention on that. And now I want you to shift your attention, and this is partly to show you can shift the focus of your attention to the sounds that you hear around you. The humming of the heating or cooling heating system, any noises of rustling or people in the distance. And then I want you to shift your attention again to your body and just be aware of any places that your body might be hurting or might be tense or might feel particularly relaxed and comfortable. Perhaps the pressure of your rear end on the chair or the tension in your neck. But just keep that breathing going, but focus your attention on some place in your body where you feel tension or relaxation. And then finally, I want you to notice, shift your awareness again to what thoughts are you having? What's going on in your mind as you're sitting here? Are you thinking very critical thoughts about how stupid this is, or contented thoughts or worries about the week beyond this one or the day today, or phone calls that you've had? Just let them come and notice them and then let them float by your consciousness. And then let your mind return to your breath, each breath as it goes in and out. And then when you're comfortable, just to open your eyes again and come back into the room and look around the room at the walls, at the ceiling, at the other people in the room. So, how was that? What was it like doing that? The reactions?
Both relaxing and as well the breathing. I was aware, I was counting like, 1, 2, 3, 4, and then forward that I thought.
Right. That's a key part of it is actually learning that you can pay attention, shift your attention. You'll find on the internet, on YouTube, Dan Siegel's exercise called the Wheel of Awareness, which is about 45 minutes long, and he takes you through a much longer version of this where he helps you to realize you can actually shift your attention. When most of us sort of feel we are victims of our brains and our minds and the mindlessness that we have very little control over it. I have a good friend who uses this with children very effectively. He also uses it in a ward for psychiatric inpatients, and he often starts a group therapy session with a mindfulness exercise, both to calm them and also to help them to be more aware of what's going on in their bodies and their thinking patterns. Now, as I said, this was very abbreviated, I combined sort of several bits of it together. But it gives you just a little flavor of what it might be like and the promise of mindfulness is just this, that it quiets the mind and allows you to regulate yourself better. So if you think of children who, at age 6 or 7, who have temper tantrums, you know, and being able to teach them a very simple thing like sitting still like a frog and breathing deeply, that's a helpful little exercise that helps them to learn emotional regulation. So it allows you to approach situations with a greater sense of equilibrium. So the Buddhist folk who do it, you know, the Buddhist monks who do this hour after hour are known for their sort of equanimity and calm. Now we'll come back to Buddhism and where it may lead you later on. But you can find, these are some of the apps that you can get. They usually give you a free trial and then of course you begin to pay for the exercises. But there are a lot of different mindfulness exercises on these. So here's Jon Kabat-Zinn again, and he says that an 8-week program of yoga practices plus 45-minute guided home meditation practice 6 times a week. So this is what he does to teach a set of self-regulation skills and he does this in a hospital for physical problems like pain relief, skin problems like chronic psoriasis, people who have Jon Kabat-Zinn, and immune function. So here it's called mindfulness-based stress reduction. He's been doing it for years. So an 8-week program of teaching meditation practice, 45 minutes guided home meditation practice 6 times a week, and then an all-day retreat in the 6th week. And he claims, and you can find his lectures all over the internet. Now, one critic, she's not a Christian, but she writes in Psychotherapy Networker, called Mary Wiley. She's sort of like, I think she's like a medical journalist. She comments on Kabat-Zinn. He decided to use what Buddhists call skillful means, teaching Buddhist principles and practices, but disguising their origin in plain American-style talk. Promoting a kind of stealth Buddhism, scrubbed clean of bells, chants, prayers, and terms like Dharma and Karma and Dukkha, not to mention the Four Noble Truths, the Eightfold Path, and so on. So she's suggesting he brought it, as it were, into the medical world and didn't use any of that Buddhist language. And we'll get more into that as we go along here. So, and here's a claim that Jon Kabat-Zinn makes about mindfulness. Mindfulness can save and grace and transform and heal our lives and has repercussions far beyond us as individuals. Wow. That's a big claim, isn't it? That's sort of like a gospel claim. This will transform the world. Save, grace, transform. Mary Wiley, it goes on again, he decided... Oh no, sorry, I've given you that quote already here. So here is... Jon Kabat-Zinn himself, quoted by Wiley, says, "I bent over backwards to structure it and find ways to speak about it that avoided as much as possible the risk of its being seen as Buddhist, New Age, Eastern mysticism, or just plain flaky." Now, Laurie, you were mentioning yesterday that there's a lot of suspicion of mindfulness in your part of the world, in the States. Is that from Christians, or who is that? Why are they suspicious?
I'd say secular society is completely embracing it. Where I live is really international, and it's a relief. I mean, people speak of mindfulness kind of as a third culture. So I have Hindu neighbors and Muslim and Buddhist neighbors, and quite a few of them belong to the same health club and go to the same yoga classes together mm-hmm. where they practice mindfulness.
Right.
So it's accepted. Where it's not accepted is in the church.
Right. They're suspicious because of its Eastern roots.
Yeah, and it looks like transcendental meditation.
Right. But you're seeing... How about the rest of you? Are you seeing a lot of talk about mindfulness? Are you hearing a lot of talk about mindfulness? And where do you hear that?
In the Czech, there's mindfulness courses starting all over the place, but... It's not being very much published. It's not something that would be so much in the
mainstream
culture yet. Mm-hmm. And the Christians have not come across it, so they have not
haven't reacted yet.
But when I try, I actually use a lot of mindfulness with my clients in the pain treatment center. Mm-hmm. For them, it's usually an easy thing to appropriate. Mm-hmm. They might be reluctant to start because it looks too simple and simplistic. So I try to, my explanations try to fit the personality
yeah.
of the person, but they do not seem to be troubled by that too
right.
much.
Right.
And with Christian clients and Christian groups, I see a lot of overlap of mindfulness and some of the spiritual exercises practices.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
that is actually what I tend to do.
We'll come back to those a little later on, and also talk a little bit more about pain.
It's not a big thing yet. But it's
okay. Common. What about in the other countries?
In Germany, it's also in the psychotherapy world. It's very common.
Mm-hmm.
Recommended
right.
a lot. Yeah,
right.
In different sorts of.
Things. So in Germany, yes.
Programs for it in primary schools.
Yeah. Programs in primary schools, and you were mentioning in schools it's used a lot. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. So, and what we've seen in the therapy world is this evolution of cognitive behavioral therapy to mindfulness-based cognitive therapy. So we used to say, as I said earlier on, you change your behavior, you change your thinking, and that will change your feelings. And now we're saying more observe and accept your thoughts and feelings rather than sort of grabbing and wrestling with them. Because allowing them, as they said, allowing them to exist takes away their power. Now here's an interesting little video called The Samurai and the Fly.
Oh, shoot. Gone to the wrong place here. Which I hope I can make work. The sound is very low at the beginning, so yeah, here we are. We've got it. Can you turn off the other lights for me, do you think, please? Thank you. So what's the message in that?
Fighting it increases it.
Yeah. Do you think that's true? What?
Yes.
So can you give an example of some area where that might be true in one's thought life?
I do it with a lot of my anxious clients. Mm-hmm. I give them the permission to own the feelings.
Right.
And to have those thoughts and there's nothing wrong, and suddenly it really loses its power. I would say exactly the same way.
Yeah. Yeah.
Just suddenly there is nothing else to fight against, so what should I think about it now?
Yeah.
That reminds me of not fight against your cross, rather take it and follow me.
Not fight against your cross, is that what you were saying?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You can't change much. When you cannot change it, just...
You have to accept things that you can't change.
Yeah, and read it through and tell questions.
Right.
That's okay, leave it.
Right. Now do you think this is true to scripture?
Yeah. Accepting that we are in a fallen world. Doesn't have to be.
What about phrases like put off your old nature? Do not be angry. Don't be anxious. Fight those bad thoughts. What?
That's what those flies are.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
We have to fight against our flesh, of course.
Right.
On some cases, life happens and you cannot just change things, but you have to accept no matter whether you
right.
like it or not.
Right, yeah. I personally think it's a bit of both, that we are called, there are times when it's really helpful to use this sort of method. There are other times when you do have to resist sin, resist the flesh, and you can't just allow it. Well, you can allow temptation to come, can't you? So if you're an addict, or you're having sexual thoughts, or whatever it is, and to allow them to go across your mind and out the other side, sometimes that works. At other times, you have to actively, more actively, push them away.
Do you think it's possible that it works when it's about a thought, but what the Bible talks about is the attitude of the heart, which is not necessarily directly connected to thoughts?
Right, right. And so,
because anger thoughts can be just like turned around and around and around. And
right. But a deeper attitude is something more settled within you.
It's a heart that is has a goal of I want to go to forgiveness, than with the cognitive thought of the anger,
yes,
know, or the sin committed against me, it is still right in front of God.
Right, right. Well, that's a good distinction between the thought and the attitude of the heart. Maybe we'll come back to this a little more as we go on through this. So just in terms of the medical, the places where in the psychotherapy world, mindfulness-based cognitive therapy, dialectical behavior therapy, you see it in acceptance and commitment therapy. And then in daily life, I think this is where I would say, as I've told you, I think being mindful about the whole of life is a very positive thing, a very Christian thing. And as I think, in this sort of way of stop and paying attention to your negative reaction, breathing, releasing the tension, allowing the negative to soften, and then reflecting what pattern of this emotional reaction is there in my heart and mind? What lies am I believing? What's happening inside the other person? And then choosing what is the loving, respectful, skillful response. It's not fight or flight. There may be something in between those. So the more down-to-earth mindfulness folk use it in this sort of way. And I think it is very much what we would call people to do in learning emotional regulation, in thinking, reacting Christianly to negative emotions. So it's part of neuroplasticity and retraining the brain. So we believe a lot more nowadays than we did 20 years ago that you can actually change your brain pathways and the very structure of your brain by how you use your mind. So you can train core negative beliefs and by learning focused attention and repetition, which reintegrates the brain. Sorry. Well, we're coming to Dan Siegel in a moment, who talks about retraining the brain as well. But another way that this guy, Terry Fralick, puts it in very sort of ordinary language is this: you're looking at your life like a garden, and you're watching and weeding it. So you're learning the practice of focused awareness, turning down the alarm, letting go of the old patterns, learning to ignore the old paths. So your brain sort of runs in channels, the habits of the brain and the heart, and you have to create new pathways where the old ones are unhelpful, unhealthy, and often sinful. So you pause and plan, and then you plant and feed. You counter the lies with truth. You allow love and compassion. You walk new paths. Now, as far as I know, he's not a Christian, but he's using this sort of helpful language, I think. And then the folk who are sort of more deeply into, especially the Buddhist folk, would talk about the experience they have going beyond mindfulness, the amazing realization, I can feel this change, my thoughts and feelings coming up, sometimes big, sometimes bad, but they used to feel like who I was, and now they're becoming more like an experience I'm having, not who I am, they don't define who I am. And that is a critical distinction too, that if you label yourself as a you know, a sexually lustful person, and you make that your identity, or if you come to be labeled by other people as a really angry, critical person, it becomes your identity, who you are. And they're trying to say, through this exercise, you can begin to separate out who you really are and what you're feeling and what you're doing in reaction to that. And I think, again, that is a Christian thing to you. Your identity is different from the feelings that you have. So, I think we've mentioned these. So on then to Dan Siegel. Now, Dan Siegel, who for several of us here is a favorite author, again, he's not a Christian, but he's someone who is articulating something that is very close to a Christian view of both of the mind, and his definition of mind is actually very wide and beautiful. But how we change. So he originally called it mindsight. He has a book called Mindsight, and he talks about the five senses and then the sixth sense of the ability to perceive internal states, the seventh sense, the ability to look within and reflect on what's going on, to focus your attention to see the internal working of your own mind, and to use what many people say, when you name what's going on, you can tame it. Before it's named and recognized, it takes control of you. But once you can name it, so helping children to name their emotions, when they just feel a welter of inner discomfort, and you say to them, yeah, it's not surprising that you feel angry when that boy did that to you. Or that you feel really sad that you lost your teddy, or whatever it is. So you're helping them to put a name to the emotion that helps them to have more. It soothes their limbic firing. It re-sculpts their neural pathways. So Siegel says, the power to direct our attention has within it the power to shape our brain's firing patterns, as well as the power to shape the architecture of the brain itself. That's a big claim. But it is summarized in this old saying of what fires together, wires together. So the more you practice something, the more it creates that channel, those connections in your brain, whether it's playing the piano or whether it's being lustful. Each one, you will create pathways in the brain. So you need to learn to exercise the right brain muscles. Learning mindfulness techniques, he says, can strengthen the hub of the mind so that the internal sensations, such as bodily signals or waves of emotion, can be experienced with more clarity and calmness. Where attention goes, so here's the whole idea of being able to know that you can shift your attention. Neurons fire, and where neurons fire, they can rewire. So Siegel has this little acronym, COLE. He's very fond of these, many of them, but approaching life with curiosity, openness, acceptance, and love. All good things, aren't they, to approach life and people with in counseling. This is how we should approach people. That's being mindful of them. He relates it all, too, to the world of attachment. That the more safe you are in your attachment relationships, the more able you are to be mindful, the less you are sabotaged by anxiety and anger and all sorts of confusing thoughts. So he has these four that he underlines, that people need to be seen, to be safe, to be soothed, and secure. And we as counselors can help people by giving them that sort of relationship, but also teaching them the skills where they can do it themselves, of self-soothing, of making safe places for themselves. And we do it by presence, how you are present with someone, how you see them and they feel seen is critical to this, how you attune in terms of really listening, noticing body language. You know, I mean, that the sort of roots, and those of you who have, most of you hopefully, have looked at attachment theory. And you know that the roots of that attachment are in the child at her mother's breast and being able to look into the mother's eyes, because the focal distance of the eyes is right that distance when a child is born, amazingly. And the child to feel the heart of the mother. And the child's heart rate often tunes with the heart of the mother. So the very physical attunement. And then in counseling, just sitting with people and being calm with them is attuning to them, developing trust, developing resonance. So this is a mindful brain state, and it integrates the fragmented brain. And so all integration occurs in the context of good relationships. Now, as I said earlier, Siegel didn't realize when he was talking about mindsight that he was actually talking about mindfulness. And later he came around to realize that this is what he'd been sort of doing all along. And he presents it very much, he's doing a lot of research on it, as a sort of scientific reality. So people who are very anxious tend to avoid curiosity. They tend to avoid mastery and autonomy. People who are avoidant tend to avoid needing safety or closeness. They tend to isolate themselves and cut off. And they tend to have little emotional regulation or very unhelpful ways of regulating. So a lot of what we are doing with mindfulness is training them to tolerate discomfort and anxiety, to sit with those anxious feelings until they begin to subside. And as Christians, we can obviously take people in, not only into our presence, but encourage them to experience the mindful care of God for them and focus on His character and His love for them. So it's used in all sorts of ways. As we've been going along, we've said most of these, but you know, improving health, physical health, relieving pain, improving, a lot of athletes use mindfulness to improve their performance. Managing intrusive thoughts, countering anxiety and depression, dealing with anger, you know, many different ways. And there are the folk who are doing a lot of this say, give some cautions that you have to be careful with people who have breathing problems. Someone who has constriction of the chest with chronic bronchitis or something. People who have been victims of trauma and anxiety, when they're following the breath, they may get triggered in some way into flashbacks. They may find that listening to sounds is easier. So listening to quieter music or a steady sort of pulse beat. So some people are uncomfortable because they think this is a Buddhist practice. So you frame it as just, this is time for you to become aware. It's not necessarily an Eastern spiritual technique. And I've mentioned Dan Siegel's Wheel of Awareness. And then they particularly say don't use it with people who are psychotic, who are severely depressed, who have dissociative tendencies with mania or suicidal thoughts. So extreme psychopathology, you need to walk very carefully because you may trigger people. It may make them dissociate even more.
What about using it with patients with social phobia, because they often struggle with a strong focus on themselves? So I wonder if that's still beneficial, because it would be beneficial to, I don't know, let the thoughts go that others judge me in a negative way.
Yeah. I think it could be a very useful thing to use in that. Yeah. Yeah. You mean because they're so self-focused, it just makes them more so? Is that what you are afraid of?
Yes, because I might want to, also, they're busy with what other people are thinking, but I also want them maybe to bring them in the position where they don't think about themselves that much, but like, I don't know,
about other people,
or like bring themselves in the position to do that.
Yeah, yeah.
Maybe it's not a contradiction, I thought it doesn't.
It's not a contradiction. I think you'd want to help move people beyond just simple mindfulness practices into exercises of compassion, of which focus more not only on self-compassion, but compassion for other people. And maybe exercises of being aware of how other people might be experiencing the world, that they too, everyone is suffering. And this is where, I'll come to that bit tomorrow, the Buddhist whole idea of everyone suffers, which we would agree with. I mean, that's a Christian perspective, that we all suffer in a fallen world. But sometimes that helps to, when we begin to focus on how everyone else is suffering, it takes it a little more off ourselves. I think probably this is let me stop here. So we need to finish and go for coffee. Thank you.